You're listening to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and this is our Tasty Trek segment with Darla and Michelle. Darla Bentley is a travel agent and specializing in culinary food travel, and Michelle De Lacerda is an online food blogger. And today we're going to talk about the farmers market, and there are plenty of them around the state. Of course, Salt Lake is the largest one, but the Logan one is the second largest. In my case, when I go, I just like to wander around and look. And I don't necessarily go with anything in mind, although sometimes I'll think, okay, I want to purchase this particular product. Usually it'll be greens or something, but this time of year I've got greens, so I don't usually worry about that and just like to wander around. So how do you approach a gardener's market or farmer's market?
I like to have in mind what's going to be in season and have in mind what I want to cook with those items. Now, sometimes you just wander in and you see, there's a whole bunch of beautiful red tomatoes and I want to make a sauce and put that in jars and end up purchasing a whole bunch of tomatoes. And sometimes I go in and I don't find anything at all. And then I alter my menu for the week. But basically going in with an open mind, having an idea or a clue of what's going to be before you in regards to produce, and then just winging it. That's the best way to do it. Sometimes it's fun to just wander and look and dream and buy a few things. And sometimes you just want to go purchase some things and have a great weekend of cooking.
Well, I know there are sometimes things that pop up that you weren't expecting, like, oh, I didn't know those were on yet. So let me get a few of those and see what we can come up with when we get home.
Exactly.
So as far as looking for freshness, how do you tell with what you're purchasing is going to be, it's going to last a little bit or be fresh?
It depends when it was picked. And don't be afraid to ask.
You can ask him if he grew them himself or if he purchased them from another vendor, because there are a few farmers markets that allow the vendor to bring in produce that they themselves didn't grow. Ours here in Logan, that's against the rules. So all the vendors have grown their own items. But if you ask them when they picked, is kind of iffy.
Oh, I always ask. I must offend a lot of people. I always say, oh, when did you pick these? So I know when to cook them.
Because I have personally seen and heard many customers come up to them. Did you pick this fresh this morning? Of course they did not pick it fresh this morning. The markets open early. They have to set
up
their
booth.
Unless
they've been up all night. You know.
Exactly. So they've been picked probably the day before, sometimes 2 days before, depending on what that vendor schedule is like. They are fresh, yes, but usually not picked that morning. So go ahead and ask, but do not ask if they picked them fresh for you that morning, because they'll just want to slap you, I think.
Okay. So how do you tell? So like herbs, for instance. Are they going to be kept in ice to keep them a little bit more fresh, or?
I have never seen any of the herbs that I have purchased on ice. They're usually in little baggies ready mm-hmm. for me to go. I'm sure they've been chilled or somehow okay. preserved, because we all know herbs are the first. They wilt quickly. They usually need to be kept in water and different things like that. But I have always just found them pre-portioned out in little baggies ready to grab. Unless it's like parsley or cilantro, then those are in the big bunches like you would find at the grocery store, but your smaller things are just usually portioned out, like chives.
It's nice usually because at most of these places, the food vendors, as far as produce, are pretty much all together. You don't have to wander around trying to find them. What do you look for when you go through?
I actually look for herbs a lot, often any herbs that I may not be growing in my home. I love the anything that's in season, basically whatever's in season. If something's come out early, I grab it up because it's fun to use as soon as it comes out.
Do you have any tricks of the trade, as it were, when you go to a gardener's market, a farmer's market? What makes it an easier experience?
Taking a basket and making sure I actually bring a cooler with me, and you can put ice in it, and then I put a layer of something over the ice, whether it's plastic or something like that,
so you don't want to
set it right on the ice,
yeah.
And just keep things cool, because I do live a little ways out, and sometimes I don't go home right away, so I bring a cooler. Some things you don't have to do that with, but yeah, so they don't ripen too quickly.
Okay. I would recommend making sure you bring your own bags. Some of the vendors will provide you with their local grocery market bag, you know, from their own personal shopping. They'll collect them and put your stuff in one, but it's easier and more convenient for everybody involved if you just bring your own totes, whether you want to bring your own plastic sacks or if you've got a nice wooden basket or however you choose to do it, but bring your own. If you do use those reusable grocery sacks, make sure you wash them frequently, though, because a lot of germs and bacteria and things grow in those, and you don't want to contaminate your fresh stuff.
Well, and usually most of the produce that you get has been pre-washed, like the greens, I would imagine.
Sometimes. I've come home to clean my salad greens and had little worms pop out and all sorts of things. So have fresh, clean totes and then clean your produce anyway. Whether you bought it at the grocery store or the farmer's market, it's a good idea to clean your produce.
Okay. One of the things that I've noticed that when I go, I need to make sure I have smaller bills.
Yes.
That and I've sold at a farmer's market before, and somebody, when you get like four or five $20 bills in a row and all they're getting is a couple of dollars worth of stuff, it's like the change goes really quick. So I know from a vendor standpoint, I appreciate having smaller bills, but I think it's also easier for me as a customer to purchase things that way. Do you find that the same?
Yes, I would recommend having, you know, ones and fives and actually some change, quarters, because, for example, I love to buy different varieties of garlic and they're 50 cents, 75 cents. And because there's always those people that just run by the ATM and grab a 20 and clean out the vendor of their change, they're usually very excited when I give them exact change or close to, you know, it's 75 cents, I give them a buck, they have to give me a quarter. It makes the transaction quicker because usually the booths are busy, they want to get people their produce and move along. If you know you're going to purchase a lot at a particular booth, having a 10 is fine. Even if you don't have cash, a lot of markets these days have booths where you can go and swipe your card and they'll give you tokens to use. So if you're one of those, I'm guilty of being one of these people who forget to get my cash. And so I'm grateful that our local Cache Valley Gardeners Market has a booth where I can go swipe my card and get $20 worth of tokens, and those I can use anywhere in the market. Additionally, if you're on food stamps or EBT, a lot of markets these days are taking those cards as well. Same process as the tokens for your debit card or credit card. It's just a different machine and a different colored token, and you are able to buy your fresh produce using those. But check your personal market before you try and use your debit card or EBT card. Make sure they
accept
those.
You can go to UAH.org, which is Utahns Against Hunger. UAH.org gives you that information, which markets allow that as far as vendors, too. It's very specific. You can buy anything. You can even buy plants to grow, seeds, things like that with the EBT card. You cannot buy anything that's prepared, anything alcoholic, pet foods, vitamins. You can't purchase anything that's non-edible.
Correct.
With that. But that is a great service.
Do you ever find items that you don't know what they are? To me, it's like the gardener's market would be the best place to explore new things.
Exactly.
So what have you found at a gardener's market that you got all excited about once you got home, figured out what it was and used it?
Well, actually, it wasn't at a gardener's market, but at a farmer's home when I was purchasing things from him. It was garlic scapes. I didn't know what they were. I am in love with garlic scapes.
Pesto.
They're my favorite, too. That was the one saw them at a farmer's market one time and didn't know what they were.
And they're beautiful.
They're wonderful.
They are, and they taste fabulous. I got mine at Larry's Family Farm, but I know that they have them, you know, at a lot of the gardener's markets. It's so much fun to find something that you look at and you think, gosh, I've never seen this before, which is unusual when you do cook and you garden. It's unusual to find something that you've never seen before, and so it's exciting to try it and use it.
And don't be afraid to talk to the vendor, the farmer himself, and say, what is this? How do I use this? How do I store it? How do I keep it fresh? He or she is going to be a wealth of information because obviously they're growing this product. They know how to use it. I wouldn't have that conversation if the booth is completely busy. Purchase your item and then come back and maybe towards closing, have a longer conversation with them. Or if you're an early bird and it's not busy, then go ahead and engage them in conversation at that time. But your vendor, your farmer is going to love to have that conversation. They want to get to know you. They want to know who's taking their produce and how they're going to use it. They want that connection to the community. That's why they're selling it at a gardener or farmer's market. And so they're a wealth of information. So be bold. Find something that's different that you haven't seen at your local grocery store and give it a try.
I'm guessing that you need to, it's better to go earlier than later.
It depends.
Absolutely. Well, she's right. Absolutely. For me personally, because I like to go when it's cooler and it.
And you have more selection.
And there's more selection and there's less people. So.
Yeah. First thing in the morning, you're going to have the greater selection. You're going to have the choice things to pick through. But there will be no bargaining, no haggling, no negotiating a price. Come towards the end, your supply is limited, but you're more than likely going to get something for a better deal because that person does not want to take it back home. They want to get rid of it. They're about to break down their booth and they still got this product. They're open.
They want to move it.
They're open for negotiation. So if you're pinching your pennies and you're willing to just risk it and get whatever's left, then save it for the end. But if your heart set on something that you want to make, then you need to get there early and get those while they have them.
As a vendor with the Logan Iris Society, when we sell our iris rhizomes, we do pretty well. But then we get to that end, and I'm looking at all these iris that are still here, and we do a grab bag, just to clear them out because again, we don't want to take them back, and we just assume people will be able to plant them and do something with them. So I completely understand that.
I've shown up at all times of the market, from right when they're opening to right before they're closing, and. For me, it just depends on what I'm trying to do. If I'm just open to whatever, because that's how I like to cook. I'm like, okay, what do I got? What can we play with? So I kind of like the approach of whatever's available. Let's see how creative I can get. And more often than not, when I go to get those items that they don't want to bring home, I'll purchase for the regular price. And then all of a sudden, a second one just gets tossed in, you know, so it becomes a buy one, get one free type of situation. But really, it's up to you. Go from the beginning to the end and just enjoy the whole day.
I'm guessing you don't want the vendors don't want people to touch the produce.
It's not the best practice to overly fondle the items. You know, we are tactile people, so saying don't do it, I'm not going to tell you to do that because I'm guilty. I touch stuff, but don't overly handle it because you're not the only one. If you're going to buy that one, well, then do as you please. But pick it up, gently inspect it, make sure it's what you want, and set it back down gently if it's not. Otherwise, look with your eyes, not with your hands.
Do you have your favorite markets that you like to go to? Have you been? I really haven't been to too many others. Logan is a pretty good-sized one, and they have a lot more than just produce. I mean, there's... prepared food vendors. Oh, I'm thinking of a certain pie I would just love to have right now. But that's the fun part is each time you go, it's a little bit different because the produce is different and what's in season happens to be a little bit different.
Yes, our farmers market, while they have the fresh meats and eggs and produce, they have many artisanal items. We've got jams and vinegars and hummus and baked goods, cheeses. We have
wonderful cheeses.
And she gives samples and I love that. There's more than just locally grown produce. There's locally made products, which are wonderful to get at the market.
What are the vendors required? What regulations are guiding them? Do they have to have food handlers permits? What protection is there for the buyer that things are being presented in a healthy fashion?
Food handlers permits, I was actually reading about this last night, that the gardeners markets typically require a food handlers permit. That doesn't mean they all do. It depends on the size. I know where I live, we have a little square and the farmers bring things, and I can imagine they don't have a food handlers permit. But at the more reputable ones, that would be a typical requirement. They are not required to have grown the produce themselves, except for at... The the Cache Valley Gardeners Market, that is one of the rules that isn't a rule across the board. So that, you know, it's okay to ask, did you grow this? So that you know. That does happen often. And then where is it from? Questions like that are certainly, you can certainly follow with. However, beyond that, there's not a lot of rules typically. When I was looking for the rules and I was, you know, I want to know these things for my own information, I didn't find a lot of those. So have a conversation with that vendor and find out as much as you can about what you're purchasing.
I think if they're a business, they're going to have some sort of licensing and food safety. If they're not just selling their product at the market, but it's available elsewhere, there's going to be different laws in
place for
that.
Especially with prepared food, you've got to be able to have. Yeah, and the health inspectors from the state do come around.
Yes.
And check things
and
out.
And prepared food is definitely on a whole different level.
Yeah.
The
produce that you grow at the market, that's a different thing. But if you're the pie person or the jam person, then you have food handlers. We participated in a different show over the holidays, and we served food, and we needed to have our food handler's permit to do that. So,
I know I have my favorites. There's a certain lemonade. I don't know if they still do it or not anymore, but you get different things. Like I've never had watermelon lemonade, for instance, and it was really good. And you get to discover these nice little things. What are your favorite things to do or to find at the market?
I like the entertainment. I love when the markets have little jam sessions and people sit around on the grass and listen to the music. I thoroughly enjoy the art. I'm not just there for the produce. One of my favorite markets of all time is the market in Ogden, the 25th Street, the historical district. It's so much fun. It's this full sensory experience, sounds and smells and prepared food and non-prepared food and just a ton of ideas, art sitting out on the sidewalk that you can purchase. It's so much fun.
Michelle, have you got a favorite?
I like the prepared food people. There's a bread company who always gives delicious samples, and they always have this balsamic dipping sauce that goes with it. I've been known to lap it once or twice or four times to make sure I made a small meal out of it. I like the actual food booths, you know, buying my tacos, my tortas, the tamales. I haven't seen our tamale person there for, I think, the last two markets, and I still, every time I go, hope that they are there. And I haven't seen them in a while. But those are some of the best tamales I've had.
You do. You get your favorites.
Yeah. I miss
them.
And then
you buy extra.
If you're listening, Tamale Maker, please come back.
Yes, please come back. We miss you.
It's a community experience.
It is.
It's a way to have all different aspects of your community all in one place.
I have jewelry that I have, some of my most favorite pieces of jewelry I've purchased at the Cache Valley Gardeners Market. I have art in my home that I've purchased there. My daughter has toys.
Our daughters get their face painted together.
Yes, they do. My daughter is not a leave the house person. She's a big homebody. There's a few motivating factors to get her out of the house. And when it's farmer's market season, face painting.
So it's an experience for the whole family.
It is. It is a wonderful experience. You can be entertained with music. They have our local one here in Cache Valley. They have a couple kids' days where they have crafts and different things that they do for the children. And so it really is a family affair.
And even in Cache Valley, there's one, two, at least three markets that I know of. North Logan is opening up a market this year. They're calling it the 25th Street Market. There's I don't know if Paradise still has one going or not. There's the one in Richmond that's at Rock Hill Creamery. And I sold some apples there last year, and it's not very big. But
does Hiram still have one?
I don't know if Hiram does, but the one up there was just very, it was very personal. It was very easy to go to as a vendor, but it was a less hurried atmosphere than sometimes you can get at some of the larger markets. So I think if you've got one close by, you might as well check it out, being right there.
And if you want to go and spend some time in Bear Lake, the Garden City Market is so much fun and smaller.
I need to check that one out. That would be a fun day trip.
It's a lot of fun. I have a favorite vendor there, too.
There's one in Joseph in the Richfield area. That's a Wildland Nursery. And besides the produce, of course, they're selling native and drought-tolerant plants. You find a lot of things you didn't think you'd really want. And then, whoa, I never thought of that. Let's get some of those. So when you're at the gardener's market, can you get your own produce to grow at home?
Absolutely. At the beginning of the season, early on, they have seeds or they have plants that you can just remove from the little pots that they come in and put right into the ground, and they're started for you. Some even have little tiny peppers already growing. It's actually how I start my garden every year. I pick up some plants of things I want to have in pots because I live in a small home, and voila, my garden has been started for me.
Are they typically more heirloom varieties that you've seen?
They are. And the seedlings are, in my mind, when you purchase a seedling rather than plant the seed itself, for me personally, they tend to live. they tend to be a little hardier. And I appreciate that they've, you know, you can even ask them where they got the seeds, what kind they use, what do they like, how do you plant it. You can ask so many questions. They're a wealth of information, the vendors, and as long as they're not overwhelmingly busy, they really enjoy the conversation.
And then I would imagine after you've purchased everything, you don't want to just drive around town and do other stuff. You want to get back home quickly and get those plants or the produce out of your vehicle so they don't end up getting overheated. And
exactly.
Then,
yes.
And plants are only available at the beginning of the farmer's market season. After a few weeks, they're gone because it's too late. But if you're there to get your plants, to get your garden started, you know that you're going to get them and you're going home. You need to get them tended to immediately.
Now, we need to make sure that we mention that the Cache Valley Gardeners Market is in a new location this year. Mm-hmm. It's no longer at the fairgrounds area, but it's moved to the county courthouse.
It is at 199 North Main Street. It's the historic building on the corner.
Well, this has been a great conversation about farmers markets. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. It's The Tasty Trek with Darla and Michelle. Darla Bentley is a travel agent specializing in culinary food travel, and Michelle De Lacerda is an online food blogger. Welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm talking with Kelly Cope. She's USU's Extension Water Conservation and Turf Grass Specialist. And Kelly, coming up for this summer, it's going to be a rude awakening for people.
I think so.
There's just not enough water to go around. And you've been trying to spread the word for years.
Yes.
But I think sometimes for some, until it smacks them upside the head, it just doesn't really have the impact.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And I think there are a few things coming into play this summer that haven't been on people's minds as much perhaps in the past. One of those things is the drought in California, frankly. And the amount of coverage that's getting in the news has really got people paying attention and looking at basically less than zero snowpacks over there and incredible reductions in use for agriculture as well as municipal use. And, you know, the entire state basically being restricted for the first time in history. And so that is a hot topic right now in the news, and we're not so far away from California, so people are seeing that.
Well, and when you talk about, is it Beverly Hills has to reduce their water by like 38% or something?
Yes, and they have actually gone through the state community by community, and those that seem more, you know, that are using more water are being required and asked to save even more water. Those that are more efficient are also being asked to save more water, but not quite to the same degree. So they're trying to be equitable, although I suspect if you were to ask the various communities, they would not think the process is that equitable. But, you know, again, all of that is coming into play, I think, here in our state this year. But we, of course, have our own water issues, and we have had our own water issues for a number of years. And so I think the two things are working together to really get people's attention, along with community restrictions that are already being put in place in the state of Utah this year.
So in California, are you seeing pricing changes? And will that eventually happen in Utah? Because it seems like people won't make the change unless they have some incentive to do so.
Right. And I think, you know, those of us who work in water efficiency look at the bigger picture. You know, what are the things that need to be put in place to encourage conservation and water use efficiency? Certainly water rates are part of that. But as you may know, the changing of water rates becomes a fairly political matter very, very quickly. And so it's sometimes politically untenable, even though it is often the right thing to do to get folks' attention and to more accurately reflect the cost of delivering, treating, and supplying that water. It's politically difficult.
Why? I mean, because if you have that incentive of, okay, if you use more, you pay more. Why is that politically an issue?
The issue is that whenever, let's just take a city council, some random city council, and they are considering a rate change. Whenever there is a change in rates to, in this case, water or whatever it may be, there is a great deal of public outcry against that. And it is true that there should be due process and work done, due diligence, to make sure that those changes are appropriate, but there is just a blanket outcry against it typically.
What's the outcry?
The outcry is that I don't want to pay any more money, period. Despite the fact that what you are paying may not reflect the true cost. And so I see in political situations elected officials facing that kind of outcry, and it's hard, and it is very difficult, and it takes someone with very strong resolution to say, I know it's hard, but it's correct, and we need to do it, and I am going to risk my political position to make it happen. I have seen it done, and those are incredibly courageous folks who I commend, but they are not the norm. It is very politically difficult.
And so then usually they just kind of cave? I mean, it's going to get to a point where it's like, sorry, this is the way that it is.
And it is going
they,
to
they
get,
can't cave in.
It is going to get to that point. And on the positive side of that, I guess I would say if there is a positive side to that, the more it happens, the more desperate the situation becomes, the more communities that do go that route, the easier it will be for other communities to go that route.
Because then their constituents will say, well, neighboring communities are doing it. So it's just ultimately going to happen.
You know, and the good news, the really good news I can share with you about that, if we want to talk a little more about water rates, is that there is precedent, especially in the United States, for financing water in a very sustainable way so that water utilities and water suppliers can cover their basic costs and people and yet still provide opportunities and incentives for conservation. So there's a lot of new research and work being done in that area.
So given the changes that are they have to happen, you run out of water if you don't make the changes. What restrictions are you seeing in place in many cities here in the state?
Well, the first ones that I've heard about so far this year have to do with landscape irrigation, which, of course, is the area that I am most concerned with, the area that I work on and do research in. And so there are restrictions being put in place, such as day of the week restrictions. You can only irrigate 2 days per week or 3 days per week, things like that. And, you know, I have mixed feelings about the usefulness of that kind of restriction because that doesn't really address the time that that irrigation is occurring for and the actual volume of irrigation. But, you know, it's something that communities are doing partly to address peak demand. And so peak demand is that time in the water system of a community when the water use is at its highest. And so by distributing that water use and by saying, okay, this area of the community only use water on these 2 days, this area of the community only use water on these 2 other days, it helps to reduce that peak demand, which is a huge concern for a lot of cities and water suppliers.
Do you see more of use of water sensors, moisture sensors, so that systems aren't going off when they don't need to be?
Yes. I mean, one thing that I would say I'm encouraged by is the increased use of some of the really terrific irrigation technologies that we have available.
And right here in Cache Valley, there's some great technology that's been developed.
Absolutely. So things like you mentioned, soil moisture sensors that can be attached to irrigation controllers and only allow irrigation when the soil moisture depletes to a certain level. Climate-based irrigation controllers that actually receive a weather-based signal and allow irrigation or do not allow irrigation. Extremely efficient sprinkler nozzles. I mean, there are a number of things, products, technologies available to help people have a quality landscape that functions in the way they want it to, but reduce their water use to a much more efficient level.
When I drive home, sometimes I'll work late, and when I'm driving home, it's just really irritating to see that it's raining outside or it's been cold or whatever, and yet there's a church that doesn't turn their water off. And it's going. It's just going, and sometimes it's raining, and their sprinkler system is going. That's
right.
The kind of stuff that I see, that it's so easy to change.
It is.
And we're not quite getting, I guess we're now getting to that point where it's going to have to.
Well, it is going to have to. And, you know, to be fair to those folks, they're working with an irrigation controller that is set. It's got a set schedule, and there's nobody on site at that moment when it's raining to turn it off. What they could do, and what all of us could do, is simply attach a rain sensor to our irrigation controllers. And this is something that you put outside somewhere in your landscape that is exposed to rainfall. And when it gets enough rainfall, it cuts the irrigation off through your controller. So it addresses exactly the scenario you're talking about.
Or you could just be a hose dragger like myself.
Yes.
Are you still a hose dragger?
I would say a halfway hose dragger. Okay. I've got still dragging a hose around my backyard, but automatic irrigation in my front yard. But even with the automatic irrigation in my front yard, I still control that somewhat manually. I don't just turn it on. In fact, I turn it off. It's off. And then when I'm looking at my landscape and it appears to need water, I go run it for one round and then I'm done. I turn it off again.
See, I think that's a great way to do it.
Yeah.
Because then you're not assuming the system knows what's going on, because the system doesn't.
Well, the system only knows what you tell it.
Exactly.
And so if you are not adjusting it through the growing season to reflect conditions outside, you're not being as efficient as you could be. And that's something that's really challenging for folks. If you ask them to change their irrigation schedule on a monthly basis, many of them are challenged by that. So that's where, you know, things like climate-based controllers come in, because they make those changes without monthly, weekly input from the individual.
And you mentioned in a circular that you sent out recently that plants actually prefer having it dry out in between.
That's right.
I mean, if you've got plants that are especially adapted to this area, mm-hmm. Which is another topic, but they don't like to be wet all the time.
No,
it's okay
to
dry out in between.
Absolutely. I mean, you can think of it this way. Plants, we have so much in common with plants. Let's look at it that way. We all need food, nutrition. In the case of plants, those are nutrients gained from the soil. We all need air. Plant roots need to breathe just like we do, and we all need water. Plants need to take water up through their roots just like we need to ingest water to survive. And so they require all those things just like we do. If the soil is continually wet, continually saturated, it doesn't allow those roots to get the air that they require. And it's not a healthy situation for those plants.
So to reduce the amount of water that's just evaporating, what period of time would you say this is when you need to water?
So I don't, I'm going to hedge myself a little bit here because of that peak demand issue that we were discussing earlier. But that aside, what I will say is that if you want to reduce evaporative losses of irrigation water, you're looking at irrigating sometime during the nighttime hours when there is no radiation coming in from the sun and less water lost due to evaporation. So that would be ideal if you can. You know, then in terms of plant health and reducing disease incidence and moisture on leaves, you're looking at somewhere closer to, you know, the very wee hours of the morning, 4 or 5, something like that.
And that's where having your system, if you have a system, can be helpful, because if you know, okay, I watched the weather before mm-hmm. last night, so mm-hmm. it looks like it's going to be a hot day the next day.
Mm-hmm.
It's time to water. You can set the system to go for those couple of hours in the early morning, and then you're done.
Yes, you can do that. Mm-hmm. But okay. I would encourage folks to really get more friendly with your landscapes this summer and get an eye for when things are truly drying out. Because, you know, the challenge we face, and I think this is why it's been sort of a long sell. I mean, I've been in this position for 15 plus years at this point, saying the same exact sorts of things. But I think the issue that people have is that landscapes can take a lot of excessive water before they start showing damage. And that is the challenge. If landscape plant materials, turf grass, for example, immediately look terrible when they were overwatered, it would be another story entirely. So that's the challenge. They are able to take a lot of excessive water before they start showing detrimental effects. And it's our job to try to help folks find that happy medium, you know, efficient use of water, quality of landscape. Everyone's happy.
And there are a number, and I mean, there are a lot of new turf grass varieties.
Yes.
That are much better at utilizing water than some of the older ones.
That's absolutely true. And if I could get on a little bit of a soapbox for a minute, I am aware of some programs in the West that pay people to remove grass. And the idea there is that grass in the landscape is a higher water use plant, and if it's removed, then whatever replaces it will necessarily be lower water use. You and I both know that that is not necessarily the case, and that removing grass removes a lot of the functional benefits of grass in the landscape. So, for example, dust suppression, biofiltration, prevention of soil erosion, carbon sequestration. I mean, I could go on and on. Atmospheric cooling. It does a lot of great things in the landscape. Okay. Having said that, we do have lots and lots of new varieties out there, as you just mentioned, that are much lower in water use. As an example, some work that I'm aware of from colleagues across the country has developed bluegrass varieties that use half the water of currently used species.
Wow.
Yes, I mean, it's stunning and it's wonderful. And so I guess my message that I'm really trying to get out, both within Utah and within the region, is that we can have it all in this case. We can have grasses in our landscapes that function in the way we want them to, that we can play on, recreate on, etc., but that use at least half the water of more traditionally used varieties. And I'm really excited because we're testing some of these experimental varieties here at USU right now. So, you know, turf grass scientists like myself, we have not had our heads buried in a hole for the past 50 years. We have been working on this topic, developing new varieties, working on how to manage them to be absolutely as efficient as we can be.
So these varieties are not yet available. They're still being tested?
Some of them are actually available. Okay. And if you'd like another website, there's...
Please do.
Okay. So there is a nonprofit organization called the Turf Grass Water Conservation Alliance, and their website is tgwca.org. And they have a lot of products listed there that have gone through an extremely rigorous testing process at universities around the country. It's a cooperative venture between seed companies and universities. And there's just some amazing stuff available out there now. Yeah.
So what makes them so efficient? Are they just growing slower? Do they grow deeper roots?
You know,
all of the above?
There is something to each of the things you mentioned. The physiological reasons, that's something that more research should be done on. But the bottom line, the rubber meets the road with these grasses that can maintain green cover under less irrigation. And that's what some of these grasses are doing. Like I said, 50%, up to 50% less water than typically used species.
That's pretty amazing.
It's amazing.
I'm going to be looking into it.
Well,
so the things that we've talked about for many times over the years, mowing height.
Mm-hmm.
Mow it as high as you can, or
yes,
I mean,
so
get over having this perfectly manicured look. I mean, it can look still
good. I love the perfectly manicured look, but it doesn't have to be 1 inch high. You can have that perfectly manicured look if it's 4 inches high.
Get over the perfectly manicured golf course look.
Yes, let's do that because typically, you know, home landscapes in particular, you don't need it to look like a golf course. And you still want to have the functionality, but you want to be efficient with water use. And so, yes, there's that relationship. The higher you mow the grass, the deeper the roots will grow. And so the deeper the roots grow, the more access to soil moisture they have, and the more healthy the plants will be.
And water less often, but deeper.
That's
so
correct.
Six
yes.
to 12 inches, make sure the water gets down that far.
That's
so
correct.
How do you know how far the water's gotten?
Well, there's a really simple thing you can do. You know, you can run your system for whatever the typical amount of time is that you usually do. And then you can simply take a screwdriver. And if you press the screwdriver into the ground and it goes very easily, you can see how far it moves, and that will tell you how far the water is moved. Because when the soil is dry, you're going to meet resistance.
Hmm.
You can also dig a hole. Why not dig a hole?
Ask your dog to dig a hole.
Ask your dog to dig a hole.
Irrigate shady areas, of course, less often than sunny areas.
Yes. So you're describing the concepts behind hydrozoning, which is just irrigating areas appropriately for the plant material there, as well as the conditions like slope, aspect, shade, sun. By aspect, I'm talking about, is it south-facing, west-facing, things like that.
Covering bare soil in the garden and flower beds with 2 to 3 inches of mulch.
That is one of the absolute best things you can do to prevent evaporation from that soil surface. And not only that, but in terms of weeding, having that mulch in your flower beds is going to save you so much time. And weeds that do grow will come out much easier.
And it's also better for many of the vegetables. For instance, tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
They don't like to dry out and then get wet and then dry out.
Right.
So if you keep that consistent moisture, you don't end up with the blossom end rot on the end of the tomato that you normally would.
Exactly. Mulching is something that I even consider with regard to turf grasses. And there, what I'm suggesting is that you return, recycle, or mulch the clippings back into the system when you mow, because that sort of serves the same purpose. Those clippings filter down, they cover bare soil areas, and not only that, they decompose and add organic matter to the turf and soil system, which then retains more moisture. So you're supporting the whole cycle when you return clippings, and you are retaining nutrients on the site. So, you know, I see a lot of companies out there mowing and going and blowing, and they're removing the clippings, and I hope that they're doing something good with them, because to me, they're a great resource. And so hopefully they're ending up in some compost or vegetable garden somewhere, something like that. I actually put off mowing and watering as long as I possibly can in the spring, because I'm trying to encourage those deep roots. And I'd encourage everybody to be doing that. That's just a really great way to start off the season. But then, yes, once you get into the routine of mowing, please do recycle those clippings, because they're a great resource. If you go on vacation and you come home and you're left with, you know, really high grass, that is not the time to return those clippings. That's the time to bag them and perhaps put them in the garden, as you mentioned, or compost them in some other way.
Anything else you would like to add at this point?
Well, I just would hope that people will be a little bit more hands-on with their landscapes this summer. And by that, I mean really having a look at things and not turning irrigation on until you see that there are dry spots, there are plants that are needing it. Because if people can do that through the course of this summer, that will really help with peak demand, and it will help with overall water use in the state. And of course, we know that conservation is the best way to maintain our water supplies. Mm-hmm. And so we would always encourage folks to be as efficient as they can with their water.
Great. Thank you for coming in.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Kelly Cope is USU's Extension Water Conservation and Turf Grass Specialist, and we'll have her back in again, I'm sure.
Thanks, Brian.
Good morning. This is Mother's Day week, and I would like to read you a chapter on sparrows as mothers. We all have sparrows in the garden. We kind of dismiss them. Here's what Andy Rooney said first. All birds look like sparrows to me. There are big sparrows, small sparrows, and gaily colored sparrows, but they all look like sparrows. Last summer, I realized this was a know-nothing attitude, so I brought 2 bird books. They were filled with every conceivable kind of sparrow. That is Andy Rooney's proclamation on sparrows, and I would like today to read you a bit from a book called Rare Encounters with Ordinary Birds by Lyanda Lynn Haupt. I am Nancy Williams, by the way, and I'm in here for Petals and Prose. Lyanda writes, "It's the summer after our wedding. Claire is not yet conceived, and all of my friends are having kids. That's what it seems like to me, anyway. In these warm middle months, every human and non-human animal I see has offspring in tow. I've been explaining the concept of the biological clock to my fresh new husband, Tom. It's more than a myth, you know, I tell him, stereotypically drumming my fingers on the counter tiles. I'm not in my 20s anymore. My chances for conception are diminishing exponentially as we speak. Poor Tom. As it happens, my young husband is in his 20s, albeit barely, and is unsure about being robbed of his romantic visions of a carefree youth. He thinks about it all, talks with me rationally, ignores me, argues with me, and apprises me of the current price tag on those tiny little shoes. Finally, on a weekend getaway to our trailer on the Olympic Peninsula, he takes me by the shoulders, looks me in the eye, and says convincingly, "Okay, honey, I'm ready. Let's roll the dice," totally calling my bluff. Do I see sudden sweet visions of Victorian prams and soft flannel receiving blankets? Absolutely not. Acid rain, extinction of species, overpopulation, children with guns, persistent pesticides, alienation of youth, the worldwide spread of McDonald's. A constant, endless litany of such images strings itself across my brain. Tom is still looking at me. Who am I to think I could pull off motherhood? Too selfish, self-absorbed, orderly. Too protective of my privacy. Too utterly unprepared. I sigh and walk out the trailer door. Slumping into a lawn chair at the Strait of Juan de Fuca's shore, I try to sort it all out. The sun is soft in the late evening. Harlequin ducks swim in long family lines. Farther out, scattered rhinoceros auklets dive and dive again. Close to my feet, a white-crowned sparrow feeds her freshly fledged offspring, the young bird chipping like a ringy little bell. It flutters its wings, begging. The female sparrow, small and brown, twists her head around to look me squarely in the eye. She feeds her baby with calm, with ease, then picks up some of the cracker crumbs I seem to have dropped for herself. I don't know why people talk about sparrows as if they are some kind of ultra-common bird riffraff. "Write about the obvious," says one well-known writing teacher, "like sparrows." She deposits sparrows and a list of other common things, like bread and hands and your kitchen table. The truth is, sparrows are far from common in the way we usually use the word. No one would confuse a hand or a kitchen table for a foot or a living room chair. But to the untrained observer, sparrows are mistaken constantly. "Just a sparrow," people have proclaimed in my presence, casually gesturing toward various species of finch, a warbler, a bush tit, a wren, or even a small sandpiper. I admit that as I ponder the two sparrows before me, one adult, one fledgling, it is my own preoccupations that lead me to project mother bird onto the parent. As male and female white-crowned sparrows look alike, this adult could be either. Knowing this, I continue unapologetically, believing it to be the fledgling's mom. The youngster flutters, the adult feeds. If you knew what I knew, I can't help but direct my thoughts toward the mother sparrow. You would not be so sanguine. Because up to 39% of white-crowned sparrow nestlings may be taken by predators, including garter snakes, gopher snakes, ground squirrels, barn owls, sharp-shinned hawks, crows, and jays. Most of these predators are also perfectly willing to eat sparrow eggs, and certain falcons and hawks enjoy eating sparrow adults as well. To avoid creating a ruckus that might alert predators to her nesting place, the female bird will, if she must leave, slide quietly and inconspicuously off the nest. Returning, she will stop flying when she nears the nest to stealthily walk the last few yards. Surviving sparrow young will likely be plagued by ectoparasites, parasites that lie beneath the feathers, including various fleas, flies, and lice. Internal parasites might take the shape of nematodes or blood protoaxins. As the birds grow, they are, as a species, susceptible to canary pox, pulmonary mycosis, and a virus that causes disfiguring tumors of the foot. The young birds will not even get a chance to host such plagues if, as is altogether possible, they first succumb to inclement weather or exposure. If an egg manages to hatch, chances are about 70% that the freshly emerged nestling will die before the following spring. Why do you do it? I wonder over the birds before me. The white-crowned sparrow is usually quite spiffy, with a brilliant white patch outlined in black, striping the center of its crown. Now at the end of the breeding season, this sparrow's feathers are almost at the end of their service. Even the white stripe looks a bit dingy. I can make no special claim to sparrow enlightenment. Like most of us, I have dismissed countless birds as just a sparrow. So it's a white-crowned sparrow? I've seen a million. But I'm sitting here in a confused mental state with hair that hasn't been washed for 3 days, freckled from the sun, dust between my toes, and tears in the hem of my overalls. I am disheveled and ordinary. A sparrow bravely feeds her chick for me to see. What do I want, a bird of paradise? Who am I to demand anything spectacular and gaudy and seldom seen to be named beautiful? Here is a smooth brown sparrow, rare in its one life. As I consider, obsess over, and fear pregnancy and motherhood, I observe this white-crowned sparrow feeding her young so perfectly, beyond any question and with everyday fearlessness. Sitting up straighter, I pronounce this bird to be as brave as an eagle, as beautiful as a resplendent Quetzal. Tom would immediately call this what it is, a hapless and unfortunate lapse into sentiment and romanticism. I shake my head and laugh it off. Come on, Lyanda, it's a sparrow. But looking back at the birds, it's still true. This baby sparrow has a gorgeous, courageous mother. She challenges me, a lump of human with a hindering mind. After returning from the peninsula, Tom and I began shopping for our first house together. Like all good sparrows, we decided to find and feather some kind of nest before laying our first smooth, speckled egg. I hope all you mothers had a wonderful Mother's Day. That's why I thought to bring you this piece, which is, again, from a book called Rare Encounters with Ordinary Birds by Lyanda Lynn Haupt, H-A-U-P-T. This is Nancy Williams, and I'll see you next time.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSR HD1 Logan, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.